On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Annie Beigel.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, the New York State Smokers Quitline, I'd like to welcome you to today's conference call, Tobacco Dependence, a Grand Rounds Presentation, with our featured speaker, Dr. Stephen Schroeder, Distinguished Professor of Health and Healthcare from the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, where he also heads the Smoking Cessation Leadership Center. The Tobacco Cessation Centers of New York State applaud the several hundred healthcare clinicians who are listening in on today's call and for your dedication in assisting your patients in the quitting process. The science tells us that healthcare clinicians can dramatically improve cessation rates when they assist their patients in quitting. So thank you to all of you for doing your role in helping your patients to live longer and healthier lives. And for today's call, we are pleased to offer you continuing education hours, including CME, CEU, OASAS clock hours, and CRCE. And to fulfill requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Schroeder has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does he have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies, biomedical device manufacturers, and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. There are no commercial supporters of this activity. So to obtain continuing education credits, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms which are posted on the website. And please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after March 12th. That's a week from this Friday. So please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible so you can get your credit. And now it's my pleasure to hand the call over to Dr. Stephen Schroeder. Dr. Schroeder?
Thanks, Annie. It's great being with you all. I actually was in snowy New York City last week and flew back on Saturday, and I understand there's still snow there. If you all could go to slide 3, I'm going to present two faces that represent the ends of the continuum of smoking today. The first is a fairly iconic picture of a young soldier after the fall of Baghdad in 2003, and that's a Marlboro that he's got in his mouth. And he is now back in Kentucky. He has PTSD, and he's a 3-pack-a-day smoker. So he recommends one of the more difficult ends of the smoking line. And on the next slide, slide 4, you can see a familiar face, and we read about his annual physical this week, and he is still smoking. He knows he should stop. He'd like to stop. He's still chewing gum. He can't stop. He surrounded himself with experts who clearly understand the dangers of smoking, as does he, but he's not able to. So our patients run the gamut from the soldier to our president, and we have different challenges dealing with each one. So I've been asked to put together a composite case history, which is on the next slide. This is a 52-year-old man who's a 1-pack-a-day smoker, has done that for 34 years, tried to quit both cold turkey and with nicotine gum, but he relapsed quite soon. His wife is a former smoker and is on him to quit. He gets his first cigarette soon after he gets up, and triggers for smoking include coffee, alcohol, and stress. He has a history of being depressed, but he's currently stable and not on any antidepressant medications. But he has other medical problems. He's overweight with a BMI of 30, type 2 diabetes, mild COPD, elevated lipids, and hypertension. He's got a blood pressure of 130 over 90 on 2 antihypertension drugs, and he's got mild renal and retinal complications. The next slide shows that he's ambivalent about quitting, and he has 4 questions. Why should I quit when I enjoy smoking so much? If I quit, will I gain weight? Should I use smoking cessation medications? And what if I'm unable to stop? So if that is a background, and these cases should be pretty familiar to all of you, let's move on to the next slide, which reminds us that in spite of all we read about being overweight and healthcare reform, smoking is still a very big deal. About 450,000 deaths every year in the United States only, 5 million worldwide, 10 million estimated by year 2030. 50,000 of those 450,000 deaths are due to secondhand exposure by non-smokers. And in addition to the deaths, there are almost 9 million people who are disabled from tobacco use, and you see them pushing along their oxygen carts. You run into them being very disabled from emphysema, from heart disease. And so this is a huge public health issue. You look to the next slide on the histogram, you'll see a number of very familiar categories of behavioral causes of annual deaths in the United States. And these data are from 2000, but they're not much different, although they're slightly higher because there are more people and more deaths. Two things in particular to point out. One is on the right-hand column, deaths from smoking, you'll notice there's a white horizontal line and an asterisk. And that points out that almost 200,000 of those deaths occur in people with either mental illness and or substance abuse, and I'll come back to that. On the slide next to it, with being overweight or not being active, you'll notice the CDC gave us two different bars. The first bar, which came out in JAMA in 2004, said, oh my gosh, being overweight and not being active is going to overtake smoking in terms of causes of deaths, and this was headlines. Then they were criticized for their methodology, and the CDC said, oops, it's more like 112,000. Still a big deal, but it's not yet challenging smoking. So on the next slide, it shows people who die from smoking, how do they die? And you'll see that there are four major categories: heart disease, lung, respiratory disease, secondhand smoke, and then other cancers. And it's pretty evenly spread out, and I'm going to show you later that we are just having an increasing number of diagnoses of why people die who smoke. And on this next slide, it shows you the health consequences of smoking. I won't read all these. I'm sure you know most of them. A couple of them are new. Under cardiovascular diseases, we've only recently found out that type 2 diabetes, if you smoke, your odds of getting type 2 diabetes are up by about 1.4. And we've recently gotten data to show that Alzheimer's disease and other cognitive function problems are increased in smokers. And this is a change because it used to be felt by some that smoking actually was a preventive strategy to keep you from getting Alzheimer's. That is not true. So one question, shown on the next slide, is how soon and do you benefit from quitting? And this takes you from 2 weeks to 15 years. I want to point out a couple of highlights. One is that at 1 year, the excess risk of coronary heart disease decreases to about half of that if you'd kept smoking. At 5 years, your risk of stroke is reduced to that of people who've never smoked. And after 15 years, your risk of coronary heart disease is similar to people who've never smoked. Unfortunately, your lung cancer rate, death rate, doesn't get down to the risk of non-smokers, but it goes down to about half of that of people who've kept smoking. So a lot of benefits, and they're staged. The next slide is from Richard Dahl, and it's the British medical physicians, and it shows that at any age from 30 to 60, stopping smoking extends life. You get 10 extra years at age 30, about 9 at age 40, about 6 at age 50, and about 3.5 at age 60. And it makes the point that cigarette smokers die approximately 10 years younger than do non-smokers, and some people think that's as many as 15 years. And among those who continue to smoke, at least half will die from their smoking. The next slide is a rather complicated actuarial table, but it shows you graphs of cumulative risk of death from lung cancer in men. The top line is people who keep smoking, and you'll see that if they get to age 70, they have about a 15% risk of getting lung cancer, of dying from lung cancer. Then each graph underneath that shows people who stop at age 60, at 50, at 40, at 30, and finally, of course, is the bottom line of non-smokers, who have a very low risk of dying from lung cancer. The critical point here is that even if you're confronted with a 60-year-old smoker who says, why should I quit now? The damage is all done. You can show him these data to say, in fact, the damage is not all done, and you'll reduce your risk of dying from lung cancer if you stop now. The next slide gets back to the issue that I mentioned of smoking and mental illness, the heavy burden, and this, the 435, you'll see different 400,000 death rates depending on the year, but this points out again what that bar showed. In this population, people with mental illness and with substance abuse problems consume an amazing 44% of all cigarettes sold in the United States. So this population smokes, has a higher rate of smoking. They also smoke more. So they're the people more likely, like the soldier in that first slide, to be smoking 1, 2, 3 packs a day. And the other thing they do is they smoke it way down to the butt. So if you go to a AA meeting and look at the ashtrays outside, you'll see just the filters. You won't see any cigarette left. And recent data to show that people with chronic mental illness die on average 25 years earlier than others, and that smoking is a major part of that early death rate. The next slide shows causal associations with secondhand smoke, and I won't read these. You can see there are many, many, many. The most recent one is the one under breast cancer, which showed that younger premenopausal women, when exposed to smoke at that stage, have a subsequent higher risk of developing breast cancer. And because on the cardiovascular side, the effects on adhesiveness of platelets is so sensitive, that is, a small exposure will do that, there is really no safe level of secondhand smoke. The next slide shows compounds in tobacco smoke, and we don't have space to show the almost 5,000, but it's not one thing. It's a combination of everything. I'm sad to say that a recent survey of nurses showed that, not the ones in this audience today, but showed that more than 50% of nurses think that it's nicotine that causes cancer. Of course, it's not. It's nicotine that causes you to get hooked, but it doesn't cause the cancer, and it's one of the mainstays of pharmacologic treatment of smoking cessation. The next slide shows trends, and it's dated, unfortunately. So a couple things on this slide. One is, in the 50s and 60s, a huge gender gap, and then there was a very clever marketing campaign, "You Come a Long Way, Baby," and now that gender gap still exists, but it's much narrower. There's been steady progress, but tragically way too slow. In 2007, we got very excited because for the first time, we were under 20%. We were 19.8%. Unfortunately, in 2008, we're back up to 20.6%. Here are some data from New York State showing that although New York was up with the rest of the country back in at the first part of this decade, you're really now doing much better, and that's because of things like your quit line, like your taxes, and like your smoke-free ordinances, and this is really terrific. The next slide are data from California, but I'm showing you because I think that they're pertinent to your state, and that is that there's been a change in the last 15 years to show that there are more and more smokers are light smokers, and in California that's defined as less than 15 cigarettes per day. You see, that was 45% of all smokers in 1990. It was up to 67% in 2005. This is important because the public health guideline, which talks about evidence for drugs to use in smoking cessation, makes the point that these are only validated in people who smoke more than 10 cigarettes daily. And a lot of those light smokers smoke less than 15, who are smoking less than 15 also smoke less than 10. It's likely that our president is one of those. So the clinical circumstances of people who still smoke are now different than they used to be. The next slide shows the prevalence of adult smoking by race. It's interesting that with the important exception of Native Americans, there are not a lot of differences between blacks or whites. Asians have a much lower rate. What the differences are, as shown in the next slide, are by class. And I'm showing you education as a marker for class. You could also do it by income or by zip code. You may wonder why there's so many people who smoke who have a GED. A lot of those GEDs occur in people who are in prisons, and a lot of them are in prisons because of drug or alcohol problems, and as you know, they have very much higher rates of smoking. You'll note that people with a graduate degree have the lowest rate. I'm proud to say that doctors have a rate of only 1%. If all the rest of the country smoked at that rate, we'd be in very good shape. The next slide is a simple equation. It shows that the number of smokers is equivalent to the number of new smokers plus the number of continuing smokers minus the number of quitters. And quitters quit in two ways. They quit voluntarily, which you're all going to help, or they exit in pine boxes. The next slide just takes down a little bit. It decomposes the number of quitters. So quitting is a function of quit attempts times the probability that that attempt will be a positive one. And there are a number of things that influence quit attempts. the price of a pack of cigarettes, which is very high in New York State and especially New York City, clean indoor air ordinances, counter-marketing, the advice of a clinician works on both the number of attempts and the probability of quitting, and counseling and medications, as we know, increase the probability of quitting. The next slide shows results from a survey of the AAMC and the American Legacy Foundation in a survey in 2007. Of four medical specialties. Only 1% were current smokers. Doctors are very good about asking about smoking and advising to quit, not nearly as good in recommending treatment, in arranging follow-up, or in referring to quit lines. And these are data that we've seen in other settings too. The next slide is an important one, and it lists the reasons doctors give, and I suspect the same holds true for nurses and respiratory therapists, PAs, pharmacists, others, for not helping patients quit. I'm too busy. I wasn't trained. I don't get paid for it. It's hard for smokers to find treatments and or coverage. The reality that it's a downer because most smokers can't or won't quit. The stigma that's associated with smokers, particularly when so few health professionals smoke. The respect for privacy. This is a libertarian country. The thought that you might scare away patients, but in fact, data show that that's not true, that even smokers who don't want to quit respect it when their clinicians ask them if they want to quit. And finally, which isn't very likely, but I smoke myself, I'm a hypocrite. This next slide, responses to a patient who smokes, in my view, is the most important of any of the slides I'm going to show you. And there are four responses, and one is unacceptable. It's the silent thought, I don't have time to help you. I hope none of you will let any of your colleagues get away with doing that. There are three acceptable responses. Referral to a quit line, you're going to hear more about that. Establishing systems in your office or hospital, like the VA does, or becoming an expert yourself. Now we're going to talk about the thing that gets you hooked, which is nicotine. So this slide points out that when you puff on a cigarette, you get nicotine in the brain within 11 seconds. And on the next slide, it shows the pharmacodynamics of nicotine, the effects on the central nervous system, the suppression of appetite, increased metabolic rate, both of which are responsible for the weight loss of smokers, and the effect on the cardiovascular system. Next slide shows a picture of the brain, a cartoon, showing that nicotine enters the brain, stimulates nicotine receptors in the midbrain, which releases dopamine, goes to the prefrontal cortex, and is pleasurable. And we get the release of dopamine when lots of things happen that are good. Sex, alcohol, for some people like me, Beethoven, high mountains. And so cigarettes are a primal, they activate a primal pathway in the brain. The next slide shows that nicotine receptors are upregulated in smokers. You can see on the right-hand side, the smokers have a lot more of these than non-smokers. And so these are permanent brain changes. So smoking is a brain disease, and that's one reason, I think, to have a little more tolerance towards smokers who say they want to quit but can't. The next slide is a familiar one to anybody who's been around someone who tries to smoke, who tries to stop smoking. These are all the withdrawal effects, and they can be very bothersome, and it's not uncommon for coworkers or family to say, for goodness sake, Susie or Jim, go back to smoking. We can't stand you. The good news is that most of these symptoms are better as the withdrawal fades, but they are very, very real, and we need to try to help them get through that. And this, of course, is the rationale for drugs. The next slide shows that smokers smoke to maintain a band of nicotine. This is why that first morning smoke is so important. And they basically auto-titrate to keep it within this pleasure band. The next slide refers to the recent public health updated guideline, which was updated in 2008, and it tells the famous five A's. So ask about the use of tobacco, advise users to quit, assess how ready they are to quit, assist with the attempt, and arrange for follow-up. And I'm now going to go on to do the fourth A, the assist, to talk a little bit about counseling and the various drugs that are used. So there's two forms of counseling. There's cognitive strategies and there's behavioral strategies. The cognitive strategies focus on why you want to quit. What are the downsides of smoking? Reframing the way a patient thinks about smoking. It's not your friend. It's your enemy. Distraction when you get the urge. Positive self-talks and imaging, sort of like what sport coaches do. Mentally rehearsing, visualizing yourself as a non-smoker. The next slide are behavioral strategies to cope with the stress. And often stress is a trigger to smoke. And so if you're working with a CPA, don't help that person stop smoking during the next couple of months, because they're going to be really up to their ears in tax reform. Develop substitutes for tobacco, whether it's toothpicks, whether it's going for a walk. Often alcohol or coffee are really triggers. Excuse me. So if you can figure out ways to, at least in the short run, not drink or do something else like a mint when you're having coffee. Other tobacco users are tremendous stimulation. So if you can get the smoker to, if they have a smoker in the house, it's really tough, but to have them at least not smoke in their presence and to tell their friends, you need to help me because I'm trying to stop smoking. The next slide is a part two of strategies. One is oral gratification needs, which are a big part of smoking. You can see you can use chewing gum, hard candies. Automatic smoking routine. Some people aren't even aware that they're lighting up when they're reading the morning paper or having that morning coffee. So you need to sort of sensitize them to that. Weight gain will happen, and for women especially, it's a big deal. Can be from 4 to 14 pounds. You need to anticipate that. Tell them that. Tell them that once they're done smoking, you can come back and help them lose weight. Nicotine gum or bupropion will delay the weight gain, but it'll still happen. If it's possible to get them into exercise while they're stopping smoking, that would be great. And finally, cravings, you can help them to distract themselves. Social support, as you see in the next slide, is very important. So if friends and colleagues can be cheerleaders and help them, that's really critical. And just slipping, you know, if you tap a cigarette after week one of being abstinent, it's not the end of the world. They need to let people know, as people say, let a slip slide. So support is really critical. We're moving on now to pharmacotherapy. And the data are, the evidence shows, that smokers who want to quit have a greater rate of quitting if they use medication. And so we're going to talk about those medications. The next slide, it shows that there are really seven different kinds. Five of them are NRT, the gum, the patch, the lozenge, the spray, and the inhaler. Then there are two oral agents. And, of course, doing counseling plus medications gives you a higher rate of quitting than just doing medications by themselves or counseling by themselves. So let's go to the medications. The first is nicotine gum. The advantage is it could satisfy oral cravings, might delay the weight gain. The patients can auto-titrate to give them the required nicotine that they want. The disadvantages are basically patient compliance and the fact that many people don't use the gum right. They use it like chewing gum. And of course, you're supposed to just chew a couple times, park it in your buccal mucosal area, and then chew on it only once in a while to get that nicotine ting. And the fact that gum chewing often isn't acceptable socially. The patch is probably the mainstay of NRT because it gives you a constant level to blunt the craving. And you only have to do it once. So you don't need to worry about how to comply. You put it on in the morning, and the strength you use really depends on how much people smoke. But by and large, the 21-milligram patch is more often used, and you don't need to worry about are they going to do it once they do it. The disadvantages are you then can't titrate. If you have the patch on, you get an urge, then you've got to use the gum or the lozenge or something else. If you have skin problems, you can get allergies. But by and large, most people tolerate even a little dermatitis. They rotate the patch, and they put a little corticosteroids on the rash. The next slide shows the nicotine lozenge. This is much less used than the gum, but advantages are similar. It's a little easier to use than chewing gum, so it might be more socially acceptable, but it has a higher rate of GI complications. The next is a nasal spray, which is very seldom used, but it might be used by some people, so you should know of it, but it's not been a very effective drug. The final NRT is the inhaler, and it doesn't work like in asthma. That is, the inhaled nicotine usually goes into the pharynx, which can cause you to have a sore throat. People who like it because it mimics smoking, but it looks a little weird, and again, it's not been as mainstay of use as the gum or the patch. Now we're going to go to the first oral drug, varenicline, known as Chantix. You've probably seen a lot of direct-to-consumer ads on this. It's a partial nicotine receptor agonist, and its early trials show that it's a better, it has better rates of success going head-to-head with bupropion, which I'm going to show you next. It acts as a common, as a partial nicotine receptor agonist, which means it stimulates low-level agonist activity, but it also competitively inhibits nicotine that's in the blood. So in practical words, how that works is that if you're not smoking, you get then a partial release of nicotine from the NRT. So you don't miss the nicotine as much. But if you then smoke while you're on this drug, then you won't get as much of a buzz. So in a way, it works both ways. So it's a very promising drug. Because of nausea, you can see on the next slide about dosing, you taper up starting a half a milligram a day and then a half milligram twice a day and ultimately 1 milligram twice a day. The adverse effects, the more common ones, are mainly nausea, which is why you titrate up. In the next slide, it shows advantages and disadvantages. The advantages are that it's really easy to take it. It's just a twice-a-day pill. It's a new way to treat so that people who have failed therapy in the past find that are often stimulated to say, hey, maybe this is something new. Maybe this will be for me, which is in one way why the advertising has been helpful. The other thing the advertising does is it stimulates some people to just quit on a cold turkey basis. The disadvantages, as I mentioned, are nausea. You shouldn't use it in chronic renal failure. But the one you're hearing the most about is that there is a quite rare but important side effect. There are about 8 million prescriptions of Chantix now have been sold. There are about 100 reported suicide and suicidal ideations and a small number of actual suicides since 2006. What we don't know, I'm going to go to the next slide, which shows the black box warning, but what we don't know is whether these are because of a rare effect of the drug, whether it's because a lot of people with bipolar disease smoke, and although it's off-label, that is, Chantix hasn't been tested in people with chronic mental illness, there's a lot of off-label use, so a lot of those people may take it, and also it's been known that withdrawal from smoking causes a rare but important, tragic number of suicides. So the FDA has asked Pfizer to do a study to determine the rate of this. Pfizer is not going to be able to because the frequency is so low. And so there is this black box warning that you can see. And it was also applied to bupropion, which has the brand name of Zyban. Bupropion is an antidepressant which was shown by chance when they used it to show that, people with depression using this drug don't seem to want to smoke quite as much. And it has the same central nervous system effect of decreasing craving for cigarettes and also decreasing symptoms of withdrawal from the nicotine. The next slide, it shows about the dosing. So you titrate up once a day for 3 days, and then it's BID. The next slide shows advantages and disadvantages. And again, like varenicline, it's easy to use, twice-a-day dosage. The major issue for bupropion is seizures. So anybody with a problem with seizures shouldn't take this. The rate of seizure is very, very low, but it's still reason not to take it. Commonly, the pharmacotherapy for people who are being given medication is combination. So a long-acting NRT plus like a patch, like the patch, which is the only one, plus a short-acting formulation, generally a gum, often with bupropion. Varenicline has not been tested in combination, so it by itself is an alternative to combination therapy. The next slide shows you what the Mayo Clinic does, which has an inpatient unit for people who want to quit, but also does a full court press often and has this algorithm where they may put on 2 or 3 patches, depending on how much someone smokes, plus a gum, plus Zyban. The next slide shows you the cost of the drugs plus the cost of a pack of cigarettes. Now, the cost of a pack of cigarettes, the $4.32, is inaccurate in two ways. One is since the slide was made, the federal tax was passed, so it's now $5. But in New York State, it's $13.50 in New York City and $9.50 in New York State. So in general, the cigarettes are more expensive for your smokers than getting the drugs. And you might say, well, why cover the drugs? Well, there's a major issue. Most patients, as I showed you, are poor. You can get cigarettes a pack a day. You can't get drugs on a daily dosage. So people can't afford what it costs to get a month's worth of any of these. The next slide shows some important caveats about the smoking cessation literature. Smoking is a chronic condition, and yet the FDA recommends we treat for only 12 weeks. I think many of you who treat smokers know that some of them need it longer, and some of them are going to chew the gum for a long time, and that's okay. It's much better than continuing to smoke. There's a tremendous variability, as you saw in my first two slides, of smokers, so we shouldn't think of the treatment as a cookbook. You need to get to know your smoker and to individualize treatment. The studies in the literature on which the evidence is based, this is the third bullet in the slide, come from volunteers. They are more motivated. So the real-world effect of the drugs or even a placebo is likely to be much less or at least somewhat less than in the studies. In the drug trials, both the placebo and the drug groups have very intensive counseling, much more than many of you will be able to do. And finally, most drug trials exclude patients with mental illness. With all those caveats, let's go to the next slide, which shows you from the Cochrane Review the different rates of smoking cessation. Now, I want to make several points to integrate this slide. One is that the usual cold turkey for people who don't get anything is about 3%. This is by far the largest number of smokers because many more people try cold turkey, and even though the rates are only 3%, they still, most smokers who quit do it that way. You'll notice that the placebo arm here ranges from 8 to almost 12%, and that's because A, they're motivated, and B, they get intensive counseling. And you notice that the blue arm, which is the active drug, varies, and you can't say, for example, that the spray is better than the patch because each of these trials was different. But the important thing is that counseling and drugs does better than counseling by itself. Now we're going to move on to quit lines. What are tobacco quit lines? You're going to hear more about the New York quit line, but these are expert cessation counseling provided at no cost via telephone to everybody in this country. I've visited a number of these. They're really terrific. The specialists are empathic. They can go up to 4 to 6 personalized sessions. Each state varies. Some of them offer NRT. New York City did that once, and they flooded the quit lines. And they have a success rate that's comparable to seeing a smoking cessation clinic or an individual clinician. Unfortunately, most people don't know about them, so they're a great untold secret. The Cochrane Review, on the next slide, shows that the odds ratios for telephone counseling are comparable to NRT. You notice the average sample size was over 1,000. So this is a very robust intervention. The next slide shows that in California, as state marketing dollars have dried up, the source of referrals to the calls in orange has gone down from the media, but in blue has gone up from healthcare providers. So we can do a major job in marketing. Next slide shows, it's an important point, that we may be at a tobacco tipping point today. Your New York State prevalence is at an all-time low. California, we're down to 13%. Utah's even lower, but they're 50% Mormons who are not supposed to smoke, so that sort of doesn't count. The national prevalence, we got really excited when it went down to 19.8. It's up over 20% now, but my guess is that in 2009, it's going to be lower again because of the 62-cent per pack tax increase. As I showed in my earlier slide, those who do smoke, the 20% or so, are smoking fewer cigarettes. Systems that get together, like Northern California Kaiser Permanente, got their adult smoking rate from 12% to 9% in just 3 years by basically doing a full-court press. They identified smokers in their electronic medical record. They offer people all the drugs. They send them to quit lines. They kept badgering the smokers. So we can do it. As I mentioned, doctors smoking around 1%, the proliferation of smoke-free areas, the 62-cent increase, and the increasing stigmatization of smoking, which is unfortunate in its causing of stigma, but I think is a real goad to try to get smokers to quit. So on the next slide, let's go back to the patient that we showed. He's ambivalent about quitting. His questions to go back to them. Jim. Why should I quit when I like it so much? Well, there's the health reasons, which we've just heard about, the stigma, and the money. You know, if you're paying $13.50 a pack, that adds up. You also want to look for life motivations, weddings of a child or a grandchild, graduations from high school, college, and colleagues. Will I gain weight? Yes. But we can minimize that with exercise, and usually it's transient. Should I use smoking cessation drugs? Yes, and we went through that. For him, I would start on triple therapy, the patch, the gum, and the bupropion. But if he asked for varenicline, I would do it, but would, because he had a history of being depressed in the past, I would certainly follow him carefully for that. What if I can't stop? What you want to do is move along the stages of change. So motivational interviewing, don't give up, and tell him that it often takes 8 to 10 attempts before quitting, and that there are now more ex-smokers than current smokers. Don't moralize, don't preach, don't give up, except relapses. The next slide, I believe, is my final slide, and it shows the power of intervention. So I'll go through the math here. There are about 43 million smokers today, a third to one half of whom will die of the habit. 70%, as you saw, want to quit. That's 30.5 million. Of those 30.5 million, 10 to 15 million will die from their smoking. Increasing the 3% baseline cold turkey quitting rate to 10%, which you saw basically on the placebo arm of the studies, would save a million additional lives. If cessation rates rose to 15%, which was clearly in the range of those studies, we'd save 1.5 million additional lives. You could put statins in the water, put mammogram units on in every drugstore, provide colonoscopies that were fun to everybody, and you couldn't come close to saving this many lives. So although we've made a lot of progress, there's a long way that we could go, and let's try to get there. I'm now going to turn it over to Pat Bax, who's going to tell you about your excellent New York line based at Buffalo.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schroeder, for that excellent presentation and for all your support of Quitlines nationally and, of course, our very own Quitline here in New York State. Dr. Schroeder mentioned the impact of Quitlines in helping people to quit tobacco use, and most of you on the call today are very familiar with the Quitline services. You've been on previous calls that we have conducted. However, we do have some new folks who are joining the call for the first time, and I want to take a few moments to provide you with a very brief Quitline overview. For those of you who have been on the Quitline calls and our collaborative calls, you could probably do this presentation. So I'm offering you a Quitline mission as a mini Quitline marketer. As Dr. Schroeder pointed out, marketing is really the key to getting out the message about the access to services. Should you choose to accept this mission, I ask that you visit our website, that you download and print one of our newer chronic disease fact sheets that would certainly help the patient that Dr. Schroeder showcased in his presentation. But share some of these chronic disease fact sheets with your own patients before our next conference call. And for those of you who are new to the Quitline, let me just take a moment to tell you about our services. As you can see on the transition slide, there is a little picture of a plastic card that we use very frequently at the Quitline that gives individuals an opportunity to know the Quitline number, our website, and on the back of the card we have information about how to quit and what services that we do provide. The Quitline is a free and confidential program. We provide evidence-based cessation services to New York State residents who do want to stop using tobacco. And we recently, with our new contract in New York State, we have changed our hours of operation, so please make note of this, that we are open Monday through Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 12 a.m., Thursday and Friday from 9 to 6, Saturday and Sunday 9 to 1. However, we do have the 24-hour access to our services, our taped message library, which is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and our tips of the day. And as our website is accessible at nysmokefree.com. Our scope of services are quite extensive. We are an information clearinghouse, and we are in the know. call us if you have any questions, and many of you have done that, and we will find out. If we don't know, we will look to find the answer for you as soon as possible. We do offer cessation coaching, which is with motivational interviewing with our quit coaches, and folks can call as often as they like. We do one outgoing coaching call. We do a follow-up NRT call. However, if individuals in New York State need additional assistance, they can call us during those hours of operation, and we will be more than happy to assist them. With the NRT, we do give patches, gum, or lozenges, a two-week starter kit to get people to start that quit process. And we do have the online fulfillment service. As you notice on the right of the slide where it discusses the Quitline scope of services, we have an example of the free patches. Click here. And it usually takes about 5 to 7 minutes to do an online application. And we do only offer the patches online. However, we will do a follow-up call with the individual to make sure that they've received the product that they have ordered. Our provider services are quite extensive. We have our online provider referral program, our Fax to Quit, and of course we have lots of different materials that providers can use to help their patients and clients to quit. The print materials are available on our website and also by calling us at 1-866-NY-QUITS to order different materials and talk to some of our quit coaches about what is available to help your patients and clients. Our website information, we have our CMEs, our Stop Smoking Clinic, and a whole variety of resources that will help you in your efforts. And information technology, we do have an online chat, which we open up to you. We encourage you to participate in. It's held twice a week, and our hours do change. So please make sure you visit our website often to check the changing hours. We are looking to expand our technologies to include even more access and support for our New York State residents in decreasing the smoking prevalence in New York State. On the last slide, I just want to close before we turn it over for questions and answers. I want to bring your attention to this particular slide, which talks about the awareness of cessation resources in New York State. And as Dr. Schroeder was very complimentary to our quit line, we're very excited about our entire tobacco control program in New York State. And as you can see, from 2005 to 2007, we have a major increase in the awareness of our cessation centers, a 16% increase in awareness of our quit line services, the fact that we do give out the free nicotine replacement starter kit, and our Medicaid benefit, which does cover cessation medications. So with that information, I'd like to turn the call back to Michelle, who will inform you as to the procedure for questions and answers.
Thank you. If you have a question or comment, press 01 on your telephone keypad. Okay, we do have several questions in the queue. The first one comes from Grover Kaufman.
Yes, hello, Doctor. Thank you for your presentation. I had a question about slide 19, which shows the trend towards smokers becoming lighter smokers, that is, less than 15 cigarettes per day. And I was wondering if you had any information as to what that reduction is attributed to. Is it just simply the fact that smokers are being more cognizant, or is it that they're smoking less because formulations have changed?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer. My theories are that it's a mixture. That is, that to some extent, this reflects the fact that it's getting more and more expensive to smoke, so that people with mental illness or lower income are having to taper, and if these were cheaper, they would smoke more. I think some are people who know they ought to quit, can't quit, but are tapering down. It's really important to know how much is the first and how much is the second, and I'm hoping that there'll be some research on that. I know that a number of people are interested, but this is a phenomenon. People used to think that the core of smokers would all be hardcore smokers, 2 to 3 packs per day. In fact, a lot more of them are like our president. People who are smoking less than they used to would like to quit and just can't.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
I do have 6 more questions in the queue. The next one comes from Richard Aubrey. Your line is open, sir.
Oh, hi. So congratulations on a wonderful presentation, and I think we're all inspired here in Syracuse to work on this even more than we have. Specifically, I'm involved with a regional perinatal program where we're trying to get smoking cessation really encompassed as part of standard prenatal care in a more dramatic way using the 5A's approach. I'm really intrigued, however, with the additional insights about the availability of
the quitlines. You've gone silent on me, but my guess is that what you're saying is something that our Smoking Cessation Leadership Center has found. Please start talking again if you get back on. But what we found when we've talked to anesthesiologists, surgeons, family physicians, psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, dental hygienists, is that they all say, gosh, we'd like to help our smokers quit. We just don't have the time or the interest or the expertise to do the 5A. People on this call may be somewhat different because you cared enough to listen, but many of them said, we can't do it. And then when I said, well, have you heard about telephone quit lines? They would all say, what are those? This was back in 2003, 2004, 2005. When I explained it to them, I said, could you take 30 seconds and save a life? Could you ask, advise, and refer? And anesthesiologists now tried that. They didn't want to do it. They tried that, and now it's the policy of the American Society of Anesthesiology that every preoperative smoker who an anesthesiologist sees must at least intervene with this shortcut, which we call ask, advise, refer. If they're going to do the other thing, that's great. But because the quit lines work so well, I think that's an option. I don't know whether that's the question that you're going to ask.
Go ahead, Mr. Albert. Your line is open again, sir.
Yeah, well, that was partly at least the answer. I just wanted to be continually reassured that recommending pregnant ladies to use the hotline as an adjunct to the 5As, there wouldn't be any confusion in terms of the kind of advice that's being given locally versus what's on the quit line. For example, the use of the antidepressive agent, which if you're going to use something in pregnancy, might seem to be an acceptable one. Exactly what does the, for example, quit line say about the use of antidepressants as part of the smoking cessation program?
Well, the public health guideline basically says don't use any drugs for pregnant smokers, or don't lead with that. They then say, you know, using NRT, if they're just not able to smoke and you got to do NRT, try it. But let me ask what the New York quit line does when a pregnant woman calls.
In New York State, for the quit line, what we do is provide quit line coaching to the individual who's calling us. Because of our protocol, we are unable to offer the NRT. However, we do have specific coaching, and the quit coaches are trained in motivational interviewing for working with pregnant and breastfeeding women.
What we find sometimes is that two things that are sort of sad. One is that any pregnant women who smoke feel so guilty about it, they don't admit to their OB that they smoke. The other thing is that those who quit many of them tend to start right back up again as soon as the baby's born. So it's a real issue.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. The next question in the queue comes from Jason. Sir, your line is open. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Schroeder. Great presentation, very informative. With the statistics, one thing I would like to mention, I was a quit line counselor from New York State for about 4.5 years doing proactive counseling, and it was something that you kind of touched on, relapse prevention, or more or less relapse, just an idea to throw out there to people that are providing interventions, that is, relapse from nicotine or going back to smoking doesn't make anybody a bad person. What it means is nicotine's addictive. It's important to point that out to people when you're staging interventions, because there's sometimes a shame factor involved, and I just kind of wanted to touch on that.
Jason, that's a great comment. What are you doing now that you're no longer a...
Well, actually, I am working for the Greater Rochester Area Tobacco Cessation Center, so now I'm kind of coming at things from the clinician standpoint. So I did intervention work, a few of us here, for about 4.5 years for the proactive arm of the Quit Line in Rochester, New York.
Glad that you're still in the field, and thanks for the helpful comment.
Yep, no problem.
Thank you. The next question in the queue comes from Barbara Goldberg.
Hi, Dr. Schroeder. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Right, okay. My question concerns several of my clients who come to me saying they would like to get the patch, and I hesitate to refer them to the provider if they're only smoking 1 to 3 cigarettes a day. My thinking has been that they'd get more nicotine from the patch. Am I off base on this, or am I on the right track?
It's a great question. All the evidence in the guideline about any of the drugs are in people who smoke at least 10 cigarettes daily. So the common wisdom is that someone who smokes as little as your client says, if she's telling you the truth, the common wisdom is that... that the patch won't help. On the other hand, if she thinks it does, if she came to me, I would run through that and say, you know, you're probably going to get more nicotine from this than you're getting from your smoking. But if this will help, if you'll take the lowest dose patch or cut it in half or whatever, and it'll help you and you won't smoke, that's good. Because the cardiovascular risk from 1 to 3 cigarettes per day is almost as great as for a pack a day. So anything, I'm a real pragmatist, and although the literature doesn't support it, I would individualize it and try it on her and say, you know, let me know how you feel. This is the warning if you get too many patches. Remember, thank you for smoking, the very funny satire by Chris Buckley. They kidnap him and they slap his body with patches. He gets like 100 patches and he goes into cardiac rhythm problems and almost dies, the hero of this novel. So you can get some toxicity. But if she gets a low-dose patch and tries it, I don't think you're going to have much harm.
Okay, thank you.
I have 3 more questions in the queue, and the next one comes from Scott Schroeder.
Thank you very much. My question was, and you referred to the tipping point, and I was wondering if you read the book The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, where he stated that he thought that it, you know, teenagers, which is what I deal with, and trying to get them to quit smoke is almost a futile proposition. I mean, we've been relatively successful because of the price of cigarettes in New York, but they're going to rebel, they're going to be independent, and they're going to try. And his point was to decrease the amount of nicotine in cigarettes so that they would not get hooked. Do you have any thoughts about that suggestion?
These are all such great questions. First of all, let's go back to why the kids start. It is often being a rebel. And as fewer and fewer parents smoke, this might be a good way to show that you're different from your parents. On the other hand, kids from smoking families are more likely to smoke than kids from non-smoking. The whole underlying strategy of the Legacy Foundation's Truth Campaign was to substitute the tobacco industry for the parents and basically say, these tobacco industry people are evil and they're playing with your minds. Rebel against them and don't smoke. And when that campaign was aired more, youth smoking went down to an all-time low. A lot of different states have different media campaigns, but because of all the state budget problems, those commercials aren't being aired as much as they were. So youth smoking is still a lot lower than it used to be, but it's higher than it was in the 18 to 24 group. It's actually going up. Why do they smoke? Many of them, by the way, are light and intermittent smokers. And so I'm not sure that nicotine is as big a deal for them as it is for the 30-year-old one-pack-a-day smoker. It'll be interesting to see whether the FDA, which is prohibited by Congress from getting rid of nicotine altogether, but has the option of mandating successively lower doses of nicotine in cigarettes, whether they'll try to do that. The counterargument to that is people will be smuggling in cigarettes from Canada or the UK. So this is a fluid situation. But my sense is that the social marketing aspect is going to be more important in trying to keep kids from smoking. Great question.
Thank you.
I have 2 more questions in the queue. The next one comes from Yamel Jaren.
Hi.
Hi.
My question for you is, when you mentioned on slides 49 and 50, and you mentioned the number of reported suicides.
Yes.
does that number include people with already mental health diagnosis?
Great question, and we don't know. All that requires to get on that list is a report of someone who was taking the drug and either had those thoughts or did a suicide. So the big question for chance, you know, by the way, I should say that when nicotine patch came on the market, I think in the 80s, it had a black box warning, and there were some suicides. So there's this intermingling of smoking, mental illness, feeling bad for some people when they stop smoking, and whether or not the drugs you use to help you quit add to that, we just don't know. And I don't think we're going to know because the events are so rare that no studies that the manufacturers do will have the power to really tell us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I wish I had a clearer answer for you.
I think we have, this is Annie, I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, and the last question is from Jason. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Jason again, Dr. Schroeder. To the Mr. Schroeder that was dealing with the teen smokers.
There's no relative, I don't think.
You don't know him, no family. I often found in my work as a coach and when doing interventions, when I was dealing with young smokers, I often felt, and talking to them, that they really hadn't been at the point where they realized the damage that smoking could do compared to if I was dealing with a smoker that was 30, 40, 50 years old and trying to quit. They're just not at that point where they've seen the damage. That's one thing that I kind of gathered in the, you know, 4.5 years I was doing interventions. I don't know if there's any statistical data to back that up or anything, but that was just an impression I got into talking to, you know, let's say between 18 and 25-year-olds.
It's a common wisdom, Jason, that young people don't think they're going to die. They don't wear helmets when they ride a motorcycle. They drink and drive. They think they get in trouble from smoking. So that's absolutely right. The other hole in our knowledge is that there have been no studies done on the effect of medications on under 18 smokers.
Right.
A lot of kids, late adolescents, would really like to quit, not necessarily because they're worried about lung cancer, but because they don't like the fact that they have to keep smoking. And we just don't have data to know whether these drugs help with it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I want to thank you, Dr. Schroeder, and on behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, we want to sincerely thank you for an excellent presentation today, Dr. Schroeder, and for all of those of you who have been listened in today. And if you please would mark your calendars, our next conference call will be on May 5th. The title is Practical Issues in Applying the 5As in Practice. And this brings us to the close of today's call. And again, thank you, Dr. Schroeder, and thank you to all of you out there, and have a nice day.
My pleasure, and this is a great time to be in smoking cessation.
Thank you.